This week, the Dow Jones Industrials finished at another 120-year record while the cryptocurrency phenomenon marched forward. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Gold Seek Radio. Your host, Chris Waltzek. It's just a pleasure to be back with you this weekend with two more interviews lined up with industry insiders. Most investors have heard of the Bitcoin revolution as enthusiasm continues unabated for the blockchain miracle. It's a big theme. Or is it just another big fad? An internet bubble waiting to burst? Or are cryptocurrencies here to stay? Deep pockets attached to deep thinking minds are positioning themselves for a new way of doing business digitally. So how big could the market become? One source suggests 10% of the $5 trillion Forex currency market, or about $500 billion, could go to the digital space, making Bitcoin 100,000 each. Now, that might seem extreme, but even Jim Cramer has tossed his hat into the ring, calling for $1 million of Bitcoin that firms and corporations are looking to pay off the ransomware to keep their information systems going. Even President Vladimir Putin is meeting with the Ethereum founder to discuss a Russian cryptocurrency. Gold Seek Radio recognizes the opportunity to differentiate among the crypto peers through precious metals backing. We're using the Ethereum tokens to offer the end user a unique coinage of 90% silver dimes per coin. The first 10,000 tokens are redeemable. In addition, Ethereum tokens allow for, or encourage even, money supply expansion, so as demand increases, low-cost silver coins can be accumulated with a total of no more than 21 million voted into existence. By maintaining a limited money supply that's backed by precious metals, Silverbit may have monetary soundness in tandem with the exciting anonymity and versatility of digital money. If you're interested in helping to crowdfund this project, or you just have some neat insights that might help us out, fire over an email to gsr@hughes.net. And joining me this week on this topic, as well as the precious metals, Bill Murphy of GATA returns with insights into the FOMC rate hike decision. Fed policymakers raised the overnight lending rate by a quarter point from 1% to 1.2%. The current Fed funds futures indicate low odds of another rate hike in 2017, and high odds for another quarter point increase next year. We discuss the forecast of billionaire VC Tim Draper in Silicon Valley. He's calling for at least $10,000 Bitcoin in 2018. That's about a triple or quadrupling from the current price. Just as the powers that be have lost control of the cryptocurrency tulip mania-like market, Bill Murphy says when silver crosses above 21, momentum traders and hedge funds will pile in, igniting a short covering squeeze of epic proportions. Then Dr. Stephen Lieb from New York returns with a compelling case for China as center of the global economy. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization is unifying half of the world's disenfranchised populace, 3 billion people, 8 different nations formerly at odds. He's watching China's economic miracle as a catalyst that could send gold skyrocketing. Once oil is denominated in yuan renminbi, that will mark the beginning of the next gold rally. And GoldSeek is excited to announce a new sponsor, Silvercorp. It's a mid-tier producer, ticker SVM. They just announced a big boost in their dividend, about 35%. For full transparency, Peter Spina, our gold stock whiz here, plans to purchase shares on a pullback. And remember, we'd like to have you with the Alpha Stocks newsletter. This is probably the only newsletter around that had people piling into the Bitcoin ETF at about, 90 to 100. Well, it recently hit about 600. If you'd like to see the weekly picks and candidates, including cannabis shares and other potentially red hot sectors, as well as all kinds of ideas on ICOs, that's initial currency offerings, such as Komodo, which has also been about a 100-fold increase, and we think there's much more upside to go. Sign up if you'd like to using PayPal or your credit card, or just send a request to gsr@hughes.net and we'll sign you up. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. We'd also like to hear your questions and comments. We have a hotline. Please jot this down on a post-it pad. 641-715-3900. Our extension number, 514049. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Partly cloudy skies appeared over the precious metal sector this week, the second week running following a much-anticipated quarter-point rate hike by the FOMC. The yellow metal gave back 15, less than 1%, finishing at $12.57 an ounce, while silver gave back 56 cents, about 6%, finishing the week at $16.67 an ounce. The precious metals XAU shares fell 5, ending at $84.37, while black gold gave back about 4%, ending around $45.83. per barrel. The top story holding the precious metals in check this week, news that Fed officials increased the benchmark overnight lending rate by a quarter basis point to 1.25 on Wednesday. Earlier in the week, Fed Chairwoman Janet Yellen and colleagues laid out plans to decrease the central bank's huge $4.5 trillion balance sheet accumulated primarily through QE operations. However, one quick look at the St. Louis Fed's numbers shows that we've had an increasing balance sheet for the whole of 2017, and in fact, it's higher now than it was in the last 6 months of 2016. So you could make a case for an increase in QE operations over the past 12 months or so. Investors were caught a little off guard by the Fed speak, a bit more hawkish on a forward basis, but despite the seemingly bearish implications for the yellow metal, gold has still advanced in 6 rate hike cycles over the last 4 decades, even when rates climb slowly. Top analysts continue to call for higher precious metals this year, regardless of geopolitical risks and safe haven buying, which continues to ratchet up. In related news, sluggish U.S. data reports on Friday included downbeat new home numbers and weaker than anticipated consumer sentiment, plus reports from China of a fresh wave of QE monetary stimulus from the People's Bank of China added to gold support. The news led some analysts to call for a renewed run to and above 1,300 an ounce over the next 12 months on sluggish numbers and increased geopolitical risks, particularly in the U.S. Elsewhere, outside the U.S., signs of improvement in the physical bullion market continues to encourage the bulls. Demand in India and China remains robust, according to one source. Currency issues are subsiding in India, allowing for easier access to the metal. Meanwhile, reports indicate big increases in demand in China, with imports flowing into Shanghai and Hong Kong. Investors just can't seem to accumulate enough. China remains the world's largest gold producer and importer. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, although the technical condition remains solid for both gold and silver long-term, which appear to be carving out a very bullish pattern in the weekly chart, suggesting new highs in the coming months, the CRB index continues to bother me. We're breaking to new fresh cycle lows, suggesting underlying weakness and might even imply some possible selling and retest of support in the weeks ahead. Moving on to the Wall Street report, mostly sunny over the New York Stock Exchange for the fourth week running, as investors cheered the Fed for its Goldilocks like economic environment, not too hot, not too cold, just right for solid economic growth without excess inflation. Investors rotated out of high-flying tech shares and energy and financials in favor of real estate and utilities. By Friday's close, the Dow Jones Industrials closed at yet another all-time record, adding 66 points, ending at 21,272. The S&P 500 fell 7, ending at 24,32 for the week, while the Nasdaq fell for the second week running, down 97 points, ending at 6207. Lastly, the Bitcoin ETF fell 55, about 12% to 400, while the Komodo coins continue to skyrocket, ending around $1.75. Wow. Higher by over 200-fold in just the past few months. Ticker KMD. In related news, utilities and REITs continue to outperform technology as investors seek their relatively high dividend yields over the potential for explosive capital gains in the tech shares. Increasing oil output in Nigeria and Libya added to reports of big rig counts in the U.S. and robust global inventories, which helped hold oil prices in check. The news weighed heavily on the energy shares. Lower energy costs tends to boost, though, corporate profits. Plus, investors are ignoring policymaker hints of another quarter-point rate hike this year. Currently, the Fed funds futures indicate very low odds of another rate hike. In addition, the retail apocalypse continues to unravel with the latest casualty, Kroger, a former employer of your host right here, and his employer, which tumbled 20% after the supermarket chain cut its profit numbers. In an ironic twist, Amazon, longtime favorite stock of our Alpha Stocks newsletter, gained sharply on the news and is now within earshot of a new all-time record high. Jeff Bezos's gamble to absorb market share from other sectors continues to reap hefty profits. Plus, Amazon dropped the cost of its coveted Prime membership from $100 this year to about $5 per month. In the hopes of gaining sales from the middle class, hit hardest by extreme underemployment figures. Bottom line on equities. Well, the technical outlook remains solid, with the 7 indicator greed fear index in perfect neutral reading set right at 50. Few signs of frothiness. I view the current sector rotation as a healthy sign within the market and expect further gains in U.S. shares this year. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio. Just a pleasure to welcome back Dr. Stephen Leib, author of several best-selling books, and we're looking forward to his next tome, his magnum opus, On the Yellow Metal. Welcome back, Dr. Stephen Leib.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's a pleasure being back.
It's always our pleasure. We have an explosive stock market, and we have the looks like the bottoming of the precious metals. Let me let you run with the ball.
Yeah, I think, Chris, I mean, everything that you say is right, from cryptocurrency, strong stock market. My guess and my thinking is a lot of this is basically centered around China. I continue to believe that China is ever more becoming the center of the world. And we're not really, you know, rightly or wrongly. I'm not making any, you know, political judgments. I'm just saying that our policies right now is sort of inward looking. We no longer are, you know, interested in making broad-based treaties, especially with the Pacific country, I mean, the Asian countries and the eastern part of the world. And China has jumped in. Now there are things called the SCO, which is the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. I'll tell you, Chris, I mean, when I look at the history of just this one organization, I know a lot of people talk about One Belt, One Road, and that's a very, very meaningful and large, potentially massive trading network, security network, et cetera, that's likely to encompass Eurasia, part of Africa. But the SCO is sort of emblematic of what China does. This organization began with about 6 countries in 1996, which was before China was ever in the WTO. Countries from Central Asia, don't ask me to pronounce their names, and China and Russia. Then they added another country in Central Asia in 2001. To the organization. And recently, within the last few weeks, or certainly the last month at most, they added 2 more countries. Those additional 2 countries are Pakistan and India. Yes, 2 countries that don't exactly have a friendly history with each other. They're now part of this really very encompassing organization, which, is, you know, offers trade, security services for all. I mean, Chris, can you hear me?
Yes, sir, we can hear you.
Now becomes, with the addition of Pakistan and India, and again, I have to emphasize, these are not countries that are exactly friendly with each other, but are part of a very encompassing organization, not just in terms of trade, but in terms of security, in terms of, you know, progressing together, etc. I believe it's 6-8 countries now comprise about half the world's population. Well, China still does. I mean, the SCO still does allow observer status to other countries, etc., especially in Asia. They denied the U.S. The U.S. could not even observe what's going on in the SCO. And I believe this is sort of emblematic. It's not sort of. It is emblematic of what China is trying to do. They are trying to control the East and the developing world. They're also looking to initiate or bring together this other trade pact, which goes under the, so many acronyms. This one goes under the acronym RCEP. And will include a big chunk of the developing world in addition to Japan and South Korea. So this is their this is a replacement for TPP. If you add up, Chris, all these different organizations, some a bit secretive, but, I mean, again, you can find out information. This is not secretive like the Trilateral or anything else. It's out there, the SCO. You know who belongs to it. You know what their goals are. And you know every meeting there's a communique, et cetera. Between the SCO, between the One Belt, One Road, between the very strong possibility that they will initiate this RCEP, China is at the hub of the developing world. This is amazing. Now, the developing world is now, and I think this is probably the first time in modern economic history, that the developing world, the economies of the developing world, and a lot of this is due to China, but these economies in total are larger than the economies of the developed world. So you have basically a group of countries, which on average, I mean, China has a huge economy, but on average, this group of countries have very small economies or relatively small economies, like India. I mean, as an example, the Philippines, Thailand, I mean, a collection of economies that do not have high standards of living. Tremendous potential for growth. About 75% of oil assets, hydrocarbons, energy assets are located in these countries. And basically, this gives China control of the fastest growing part of the world that now has become the most important part of the world. And I think this is what you are basically seeing now. I mean, the good side of it is that we do have worldwide growth. And it's not bad. It's well over 3%. That's pretty good. The bad side of it is that growth is centered in the eastern part of the world. So you're getting this split. And my own take is that, and I know this sounds paradoxical. Today I'm looking, at my screen, I'm seeing oil down another $2 or $1.80. And, I see, West Texas trading at about $45. There was a time where these kinds of low oil prices would have been cheered in this country. But now is not the time. And the reason is suddenly higher oil prices in the U.S., not for the rest of the world necessarily, but in the U.S., are bullish for the economy. We had a whole bunch of data today, which was pretty crummy. Inflation was lower. I think retail sales, I mean, everything that, came out was lower. If you look at the data, you will see that so much of our job creation over the last 4 or 5 years, a huge portion of that job creation has come from, guess what? The fracking industry. I mean, fracking is a very expensive in terms of how much resources it takes up, and in terms of how many people it employs. I mean, it's remarkable. I mean, some estimates are several million people. Compare that with 100,000 people or so that work for Saudi Aramco. Fracking is not just, putting a fork in the ground or putting a pole in the ground and just watching the oil stir up. It takes unimaginable amounts of sand, water, etc. Drilling, I mean, it's a very, very intensive profession. It takes a lot of people. It takes a lot of energy. But the bottom line is it allows us to circulate money throughout this economy. And that's what's been keeping us going. Now, sooner or later, that's going to stop. I mean, sooner or later, the Saudis will cut back enough. In past periods, they've cut back much, much more than they have in this period. They will cut back enough that oil prices will start to rise, and they'll let our economy go. I mean, and, we'll use up a lot of oil, et cetera, but once oil prices rise, fairly dramatically, I think this economy will be on even better footing. But I also think we will get to a point where the Chinese will say, and this is what I'm coming down to in my very long-winded way. I think the key to gold really breaking out will be when you see, and I think it's not a question of whether, it's a question of when, a Eastern benchmark for oil trading in, are denominated in Chinese yuan, Chinese renminbi. And that, in my opinion, will basically change the entire calculus of the world. It will shift the major market in oil to the east, which is where all the demand will be. I mean, you know, we have no growth in energy demand to speak of in this country, and I think the only growth we have comes from fracking, because we need so much energy to get that energy. But basically, the developed world doesn't need to grow their energy, their service economies, etc. It's in the developing world, which is now larger than the developed world, where you're going to see this growth in energy demand. And it's going to be pretty spectacular. I mean, some of these countries that are developing, I mean, they may have $1,500 per capita incomes. I mean, you know, that's a long time, long room for growth, a long, long, long runway. They will be basically in charge. And I think that's when you will see a massive point of inflection. Now, if you ask me when that's going to happen, when will China start trading this benchmark? They've been talking about this for the last 3 or 4 years. There were rumors that they gave up on it this year, but then they said, no, 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 it's on our agenda, etc. And my guess is because of what's happening, because of this opening that has been created for them to, you know, really become the hub of not just, you know, the East, but the developing world, it may come sooner rather than later. So, you know, the message is that we finally have, I think, a major, what I would call the buy signal for gold. And that, again, will be when oil starts to trade on the Shanghai Exchange, denominated in renminbi. Now, it may not be, that doesn't mean the day that starts happening that gold's going to shoot up $300. No, but it means that it will happen. I think that's one reason why you've had, you know, a bid under gold at this point. To be honest, I'm somewhat surprised that gold hasn't gone down. I mean, I still expect to get another correction in gold. This is, you know, again, I want to leave your listeners with a very clear, in my opinion, I mean, I could be, you know, dead wrong on this, but in my opinion, a clear buy signal will emerge when oil is traded in renminbi in the East, because that will become the primary benchmark, not only for oil, but then again, all other commodities will be traded in the East, will be denominated in renminbi, and renminbi will be, to some extent, I can't describe to you exactly how cryptocurrencies may enter into it, but gold will be part of that equation. I mean, it'll be initially backed by renminbi, and then it'll be renminbi plus, you know, maybe the ruble and gold. And, you know, you talked about cryptocurrencies and this, you know, urge to get a hold of something that's tangible. It will be very likely a cryptocurrency that ends up backing oil trades, other commodity trades, along with the, and that cryptocurrency will consist of partially gold, partial renminbi, partial some other currencies. The dollar will have very, very little role. And the currency and the part of that collection of currencies, which will be a type of cryptocurrency, there'll be a blockchain associated with it. And incidentally, just as a sidebar, China right now has the world's fastest supercomputers, and there's a reason for that, because they see ahead. I mean, it's remarkable how far ahead that they look. So this is basically the heart of the transition that I think you have to be looking for, and I think it's just a matter of time. So, I mean, if you do see a correction in gold, If I happen to be right about this, and you do get something of a correction, and I'm not talking about a 20%, nothing like that at all. I'm talking about, you know, maybe it could be, you know, back to 1200, maybe, you know, undercutting that. And you know, I could be dead wrong. But the point is that if you do see something like that, please don't panic. Don't get upset. We are so close to seeing a major, major shift, a major point of inflection, and all the pieces will, you know, basically come together. I just have to leave this discussion with one point. I mean, the advantage the Asian cultures have is they tend to look so far ahead. I mean, back in 1978, China was mining, I don't know, 6 tons of gold. And they set up a division of their army to go out and, you know, dredge some fields and find out where all the gold was in the country. Now you flash forward, what is it, 40 years? And though China doesn't have massive gold reserves, they are the largest gold producer in the world. And they're mining about 20% of their reserves a year. I don't think in the history of commodity record keeping we've ever found a country that was mining that percentage of their reserves in a year, on a yearly basis. And every year they spend more and more money. I mean, they're losing money mining gold, and their accumulation of gold, you know, who knows? But it's enormous at this point, you know, so it's just something else backing things up.
A couple of just key little points here. Vladimir Putin, you may have read, he's meeting with the founder of Ethereum cryptocurrency. That's currently now the second currency just below Bitcoin. You might think of it as, I don't know, the Yahoo under Google. Or this is key because he is thinking strategically. We have a $5 trillion Forex market, so much larger than stocks and bonds, which the typical investor is thinking about. Well, this $5 trillion market, we're looking for up to 10% in the digital space, not just Bitcoin. Bitcoin to absorb about 33% of that 10%. So let's say 3.3%. When you run the numbers, you're talking about a $500 billion market space, if you will, for the digital currencies. This is the best estimates we're seeing from analysts today. Then we multiply that by 10 and we have a market cap on Bitcoin. If you take, let's say, about 35%, you're in the neighborhood of $1.75 to $2 trillion potentially for Bitcoin over the next 10 years or so. What we expect is a 30-fold increase from the current $2,000 to $3,000 price on Bitcoin up to as high as $100,000. That's the thinking there. This is a huge opportunity. I'd like to know your thoughts on the Bitcoin revolution.
I think it's very interesting. I was careful when I was describing how this will end up working because I'm not that sure. I do think that blockchains will be at the center. There's very little doubt. And each of these cryptocurrencies has their own blockchain associated with it. China, incidentally, is the dominant player in Bitcoins. And it's very difficult to create an additional Bitcoin. And that's a very nice thing about it. And it does make it, because it is well known, and maybe China will elect to go with the Bitcoin as to back up gold. And I think you make a really, really good point. Whatever cryptocurrency or combination, maybe it'll be Bitcoin plus another cryptocurrency, maybe they'll have three blockchains associated with this, sort of like an SDR, a crypto SDR, if you will. I mean, crypto coin SDR, and I think it'll be some sort of combination which is used to end gold. And gold will be there because gold is really essential. I mean, you can't, it's hard to, I understand the advantages of Bitcoin. I mean, it's very hard to create a Bitcoin, which is why you need these supercomputers to do it. And it's why China, I think, has put so much effort into going into developing these supercomputers, and why they dominate the Bitcoin market. Last I read, they had a, you know, remarkable share of that. So you could be dead right on this. I don't know how China is thinking. Do they want to set up, you know, another cryptocurrency? Do they want to set up several cryptocurrencies? Do they want to let the Bitcoin rise to, you know, very, very high levels? Because it would. I mean, you put your finger on it when you said that, you know, some incredibly large number per Bitcoin could be. And it could be a wonderful play, and I would not discourage it. I mean, it's certainly wholly consistent with what I think, that cryptocurrencies will play a very important role in what becomes the new monetary system. But gold, I think, will play a critical role as well, because gold is there. It's been there for several millennia, and it will join cryptocurrencies I think the most important paper currency will be the renminbi. And, you know, that will solidify China's, you know, basic control, commodity trading throughout the world. You know, it's fascinating what's happening. I hope things work out okay for us, but we're going to have to get on our horse real quickly in this country and realize what's happening. How could we, Chris, fall behind in supercomputers.
I've recently fallen under the spell of quantum computing, and I'll wager that you probably have read up on this topic as well.
I know it reasonably well, but maybe not as well as you, but I have read a lot about it, yes.
And as you may know, it works fantastically on tough-to-solve P versus NP-style problems.
But, I mean, it's funny because what the type of problem that they are really great at are called embarrassingly.
You're exactly right, and it's cracking so many interesting codes, really. I know a lot of my listeners are cringing, saying, Chris, come on, P versus NP, that's just the tip of the iceberg. But I haven't read enough to know all of the applications, but what I find amazing is you may have seen the D-Wave computer. It's this amazing black box, and it takes up a whole room. You know, it reminds me of ENIAC, if you can go back to your ENIAC days.
PhD and master's, I have a master's in math, PhD in psychology. And when I was there, I mean, I'm dating myself. I mean, we used to have to fill out these punch cards, you know, hand them in, and you'd get, you know, your multiple regression or whatever it was, whatever you wanted to do with your data, it would take you overnight.
Exactly. We're working with, you know, SAS, the SAS programs. We weren't far from your punch cards. Let me just tell you, we were just a step beyond that. So things have changed so much. And one thing I'd like to share with you before we move on, because I feel like this topic's going to change quickly. There's so much good stuff for an ICO, which, of course, is an initial cryptocurrency offering. You might just liken it to an IPO. What we're working on is called BitSilver.
You're right there with what I'm saying.
Here's our quick pitch. We recognize the opportunity to differentiate among the crypto peers, because they keep coming back, you know, these top folks in the ICO sphere. They keep saying, why would we need a metal backing when we have this digital currency? It might come in handy at some point. Why don't I let you run with that?
No, I think it definitely will come in handy at a certain point. I mean, one thing, it's very, very hard to create, again, particular cryptocurrencies, and it may take more than one. Because, I mean, you were talking about, I can't remember the number or the price that the Bitcoins would have to trade at, because basically I think that there's an ultimate number they can create, and after that can't create any more.
Yeah, Jim Cramer recently threw out a pie in the sky number, $1 million. He explains why. The ransomware, WannaCry viruses that are going around, the institutions are so desperate to pay off those ransoms, they have to use Bitcoins to do it. That was his argument. The other argument comes from the venture capitalist who's opened up a university way out in Silicon Valley. Draper is calling for a much more, I think, conservative number of 100,000.
I think that you're absolutely right. It could be, you know, that the value of a Bitcoin or any crypto coin could end up being very, very high. But the worry here is that sort of the value here is in the eye of what people want to pay. It's not underlined by anything that's real. It's underlined by things that are in the ether, literally, etherware, whatever, Ethernet. And that might worry people. And that's why I think you need something that is real, that can be tied directly into the blockchain that defines these cryptocurrencies. And that will assure that you can't have somebody doing some sort of short raid or getting together and saying, let's sell this and get these things down very low. You won't, because they'll be able to fix the price of gold, which is out there and is something anchored in the ground and or above ground. Most of gold, a huge percentage of gold that exists on this planet has already been dug up. And if you could, you're going to have to anchor it to that to avoid, again, what could be, you know, a massive short raid on the world's reserve currencies. I mean, you know, that possibility might be reasonably remote. I don't know enough about everything that would go on there and what it would, you know, what it would take to do that. But you don't want that as a possibility on a worldwide reserve currency. And the way to avoid that is to make these different blockchains that are associated with the different cryptocurrencies backed by gold. Those blockchains, along with, again, I think several paper currencies, to me, I mean, I could be wrong on this, I'm guessing, but to me will be what defines the next reserve currency in the world. I mean, you'll probably have the SDR currencies. Renminbi will get a spectacularly high weighting. But gold and cryptocurrencies will be very, very much part of the mix. It only makes sense. You've got to have cryptocurrency. You can't send gold from shore to shore. You've got to have a way of keeping, you know, the identity of gold and how much, et cetera. And you know, cryptocurrencies are exactly what the Chinese are focusing on. And I think it's why they've spent so much time developing the kind of hardware they're going to need to create these cryptocurrencies and why they've stepped ahead of us.
The currency controls that are frightening the daylights out of institutions and Chinese citizens right now, and what a neat alternative. That seems to be a big driver here.
Yeah, I think it's a huge driver, and it could be, you know, I think people are sort of getting the sense that this world is, we're living through, Chris, in my opinion, a point of inflection. You know, as you said, the hardware, I mean, you're talking about quantum computers, they have certain limitations. I mean, you know, and I think that it will not be it'll be a long time before you see a quantum computer being able to create a Bitcoin. Because it, you know, it requires a lot of programming, a lot of calculations that are extremely, exceedingly complex, would be very, very hard to program in terms of quantum computation. But not true with, you know, what are today's supercomputers. And again, I come back to the fact that, you know, a decade ago, 15 years ago, I don't think China had any supercomputers. Now all of a sudden they have at least as many as the U.S., and they're on the verge of creating probably the first supercomputer, and that might be it. You might not be able to go any higher than that because not because there's any physical limitations, but because these computers use so darn much energy that it's hard to get the energy. It's hard to situate them. And China, basically, again, I don't know whether this is because they thought so far ahead, but they have such a lead in hydroelectric power that they have probably 20 times as much hydroelectric power as the next largest country. That is so important because it's a free source of electricity. You don't need natural gas. You don't need oil. You don't need sun. You don't need wind. I mean, you don't have to count on, you know, sun shining, wind blowing, et cetera. You just count on water. And it's there. And it's cheap. It's not cheap. It's almost free. And that's where they've designed their, you know, major computing labs, right around these hydroelectric plants, which it's brilliant. I mean, you just have to salute them. I mean, you know, for how far advanced how far in the future they have positioned themselves. And in terms of a world in which cryptocurrencies play a major role, it's astonishing, you know, how well prepared they are for this.
Nikola Tesla is just flipping around in his grave hearing you say this because, as you know, he brought the whole concept of hydropower to Niagara Falls area. Yeah, lit up all of New York.
I mean, electric cars have been around forever. But, I mean, you know, again, I, you know, just sort of as a sidebar, when you look, you mentioned Tesla, and I look at Tesla with its valuation higher than that of GM, and I think some of that is merited. But Tesla will never be able to dominate the worldwide EV market because we don't have the resources here. I mean, literally, the hard resources. We don't have heavy rare earths, which is essential for creating the most efficient electric motor. Tesla's had to rely on a different type of motor. I believe it's called an induction motor. We don't have cobalt supplies, which are very important in creating the most efficient batteries. We don't have really graphite supplies, which are, you know, natural graphite. We have synthetic graphite, but you need oil, basically, to create synthetic graphite, and it turns out to be more expensive than the natural. China not only has these minerals that are needed for the battery and the engines of the most efficient electric cars, they also have a vertically integrated supply chain. They can take a heavy rare earth in the ground and turn it into a permanent magnet and insert it into the motor of an electric vehicle. We don't have access to any rare earths. So, you know, I think Musk, he probably is a total complete genius, but he's operating with one hand tied firmly behind his back, not of his own doing, but the doing of a government here that basically just was not foresightful. They were not thinking ahead. And you look at BYD, and I think I can't remember the initials, again, another acronym associated with the largest battery manufacturer in China. Basically, they dominate the rechargeable battery market, you know, because of their access to all these other minerals. You could multiply Tesla, you could multiply his IQ by 100. He can't create heavy rare earths. He just can't. We don't have it here. And we have fallen behind, and we just have to get on our horse. I'm not giving up on America. I love America. But, I mean, we just have to realize that we've got to be thinking far, far more ahead.
You brought up so many great points here, and I'd just like to emphasize one thing about Nikola Tesla. That man created the entire electronics revolution, the electronic dynamo, which, as you know, runs those electric cars you're talking about, the wind power that we have, the fan in our windows, the fan in your computer and in your laptop, that he also created wireless technology that we're using in drones today. And his father would play a game with when he was very young, and the game was Read My Thoughts. And they would sit together and attempt to read each other's mind. And he claimed in some of his notes that that sparked much of his creativity. I just wanted to throw that out there.
It's absolutely true. And, you know, I think that there are factors beyond what you see on tests that really do define those people that are, you know, just extraordinary. And I think that, you know, again, I keep coming back to the Chinese, but I mean, their advantage over us is not that they're smarter in terms of IQ tests or any of these other tests, so they do exceptionally well, math and reading. It's because, you know, they have their nose to the grindstone. But there's also this kind of emotional intelligence, and the fact that you're comfortable and yet you want to be creative. There's an urge to create. And I think that there's an urge to, you know, for the Chinese to think ahead. When the psychologists, you know, try and compare cultures, Asian or Eastern versus Western, and they show pictures, the Westerners tend to focus on the center of the picture, whereas the Easterners, the Asians, etc., they tend to focus on the entire picture. They want to get the entire panorama. And this is not something that, you know, is necessarily related to anything that we would say are numbers and symbols. It's just sort of an attitude. Again, sidebar. Right now I'm reading a series of three sci-fi books that were written and bestsellers in China. And they've come here. I mean, the first volume is called The Three-Body Problem. And it's
oh yeah, Henri Poincaré, one of my favorite mathematicians.
The birth of chaos. But, you know, this three-body problem is at the center of this book, which is interesting in itself, but that's not what really got to me. What got to me is that basically these books are dealing, I'm not giving away anything about them that you can't read on the covers of the books. These books are dealing with a problem, a major problem, I'll leave it at that, that is going to occur 450 years in the future. The Chinese are there preparing for it now. Extraordinary. I mean, Americans don't think like that. I mean, 450 years, if you told them that, you know, there's going to be something forward, if they told us, and me, I'm not being self-righteous about this. I'm at fault too. But if you told, I think almost, you know, that if you announced to the Americans that someone got on the phone, the president of the country got up there and tried to get people to work for a problem that was going to become real in 450 years, I think you'd just get a lot of blank stares. Yet, this trilogy of sci-fi stories is exactly about that. And it takes you through it. And it's, you know, it's fascinating. It really is. And it's wonderful reading for people that like sci-fi. I'm not a great sci-fi fan, but I find these books totally riveting on many, many different levels.
Well, you've piqued my interest. Can you toss us any hints on the title or the name or so we can look for them?
Sure. I mean, the title of the first book, in fact, I have, the title of the first book is The Three-Body Problem. Don't ask me to pronounce the name of the Chinese author. The title of the second one is The Dark Forest. You can get all these books on Amazon, and I'd rather mention them than my own book. And the title of the third one, I think, is something called After Death. Oh, Death's End. The Death's End. That's the third one in the series. And I'd invest the time. If you find sci-fi interesting, you're going to find this stuff exceptionally interesting.
Oh, the third one really sounds exciting because I know where that's headed. And immortality, it has to be an uploading of consciousness.
No, you could be right. But these are books I think people should read to get an idea. You know, I've studied China very, very closely for a long period of time. I read and read and read. But I've probably learned more from reading their fiction than from their nonfiction. I mean, and one good takeaway here, and it's the Chinese are not looking for worldwide hegemony. They're looking for a better world for their people. I think they realize that has to occur in the context of a better world for everybody.
I'm going to put links up on all of these. I've got it right here. The Dark Forest, Remembrance of Earth's Past by Liu.
Death's End is now just in hard copy, as far as I can tell, but will come out in paperback very soon. The Three-Body Problem is the first. The Dark Forest is the second. Death's End is the third.
I've got them right here, Three-Body Problem, and it's just $8.96 on paperback. We're going to put all these links up.
Link them, and you know, hopefully the next time we talk, yeah, I can tell you the title of my new book, which will be on China and gold. I think we're going to call it Gold Alert, China Equal $10,000 Gold.
You know, he has another book. It's called The Wandering Earth.
You know, I'm just became aware of these because they were given to me as gifts, because people know I read a lot of them. Bear in mind, and one other thing I'll say, usually when you read these kinds of translations, especially going from Chinese to English, it can be, you know, terrible. This is a brilliant translation. These books are just something I look forward to. This is my treat.
Can't wait for The Three-Body Problem. I'm starting off there.
Like the next time, I hope to be able to give you the title for my own book. But right now, I think these three books are more important. If you Google me, if you just Google my name, you'll find a webpage you can go to. Next time, I'll have the information right in front of me.
Very excited. Dr. Lieb, thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris. It's a pleasure as always.
Bill Murphy runs Gold Antitrust Action Committee, GATA, with Chris Powell, and they're exposing all the gold market manipulation. Welcome back, Bill Murphy.
Thanks for having me.
Any thoughts on the rate hike? Looks like the last rate hike for the year, though, so that sounds like a plus for the precious metals sector.
Yeah, it goes on to show what a farce this thing is, what GATA has been talking about for 18 years. And the reason I say that is, you know, we finally had some great action in gold and silver. Silver was up 50, 60 cents, and gold was up to 1280. And here's the point. It was up, as James McShirley of GATA has pointed out over and over again, exactly to 1%. They do this over and over again. It gets up 1%, and they stop it. And they kept it there pretty much, you know, for all of yesterday. Then they sold gold and silver right on the COMEX close. Another half hour, they came out with the Fed thing, which was in the market, as you just stated, and they just slaughter at $20, and silver gives up most of its gains. And we have seen this kind of thing over and over again. It just goes on and on. It is ludicrous, but that's the way it is.
Pretty solid economic numbers, at least unemployment figures lately. Do you think they're concerned that the Fed might continue raising rates and the short-term impact of that on the metals?
Well, that's a good point. As I think you probably mentioned before, when rates went down for 5 years, it didn't mean anything for gold. Why should rates going up mean anything? I know what everyone says, but it's just not the facts over the last years haven't worn out the opposite. And most importantly, from my standpoint, the numbers are really conspicuous in a way in terms of our economy. And the real key, what some will talk about, and rightfully so, is how the yields of the 10-year T-note can't get out of their own way. And they were just down to yesterday. They made a new low for the move ahead of Fed peak at 2.11% and closed at 2.13%. Way, way off its highs, even though the short rates are going up. So something is way out of sync there. And I think things are far worse, or at least a little worse, than the establishment's portraying.
It really looks as though investors just can't get enough of U.S. equities, capital from around the world. As long as people are focused on that particular sector, do you think that will continue to cap our gains?
One thing for sure, I mean, if you're in other assets, real estate, Bitcoin, the stock market, art, you're doing great. You're in gold and silver, and it's horrible, you know, over the past number of years. It's because what they've done. Now, I'm not a negative in any way, in the sense that I think what we're leading to is something extremely violent. This has gone on far too long. The central banks are backing all of the stock markets right now. Even Rick Santelli on CNBC suggested that today, and how long can it last, and so on. And I think what my opinion is that the change is coming. It will be volatile. It will come out of nowhere, and it will be dramatic.
I mean, this is what we've seen play out over the last few decades. Markets, they just run on much further than people expect until all you hear is the bullish mantra. We're at a new permanent plateau. Every other day, there's another pundit online calling the top. They've been doing so for years, and very few people get out of the way of the locomotive once it turns. Any other comments for listeners on the precious metals?
Well, just what I mentioned, I think it's going to lead to something spectacular. And as we've been discussing here, this has gone on for so long. Every dip is being bought in the stock market and all these other assets, and it's made our world and the precious metal sector very, very difficult. And as you're mentioning, and it's so appropriate, it's leading to something spectacular out of nowhere. And it's coming, and but predicting the time is impossible. So all I can do is to try to explain it to my people and to, you know, people like yourselves, your listeners, and I know it's coming. I just got to hang in there.
They're talking now, at least analysts, at about a 10% of the $5 trillion Forex global market. What I find intriguing here is people not recognizing the precious metals as a contender right along with the cryptocurrencies, because characteristics, gold and silver, that is, that, you know, the cryptocurrencies lack. There's literally nothing tangible. The focus might shift away from the really neat aspects of these cryptos and maybe return to what is tangible, what's real. I don't know what it's going to take to make people wake up. Do you have any thoughts?
There's two key points here, in my opinion. One is that what is happening compared to the cryptocurrencies, the gold and silver, which have a production point, which is the, you know, and cost, which the Bitcoin is not even the same ballpark. It just shows how much it's manipulated and suppressed, because gold's a barometer of U.S. financial market health. It's been that way for a very, very long time. The gold cartel does not want the price to go up to reflect various things about the dollar and so on, the economy and so on. And as I've said many times, Paul Volcker, former Fed chairman, said up is bad, down is good when it comes to the gold price. But secondly, is that what Bitcoin has done when the change comes, as you just discussed, when it comes back into gold and silver, because of there's all this pressure, like in a pressure cooker, it's going to be violent. And that's what's something I'm absolutely sure of. And the move is going to be up like we just had in Bitcoin, which went from 1,200 in February to 3,000.
The speed at which these cryptos are ascending is really almost unprecedented. You know, it reminds one of silver back in 1979, 1980. The powers that be have virtually no way to short these markets. You see, they're not a regulated market, but there really isn't a easy way not only to purchase in size for, let's say, big institutions and hedge funds, but it's even tougher to short, to sell against these markets. And, you know, God is always talking about this huge short position, paper short against gold and silver. When the explosive moment arrives, that shorting, that naked hedging will be exposed.
Especially in silver, when it, in my opinion, you've heard me say this before, when silver gets above 21, you are going to see similar price action than we've seen in Bitcoin, because, you know, we would call them, I would call them, they're always short, and they always get more short every rally, and at some point, when they hit the wall of the physical market, and they're forced to cover, who is going to sell? They have been the sellers for so long, there isn't anybody else. There'll be some minor and reasonable producer hedging, but that's it, because once you take out the 21 area, every speck in the world's going to want to be long. So if the bad guys are forced to cover, who's going to sell?
When it gains that momentum that you've been forecasting for over 15 years, there will be nothing to stop it. And I think the case in point is Bitcoin. Billionaire VC in Silicon Valley has a forecast of 100,000 on Bitcoin. You know, you could just see the cringing faces on CNBC. And this was about 3 years ago when he made the pronouncement. Now folks are scrambling to get as many Bitcoins as possible. And people know what gold is. It's tangible, though. They can hold it. It has a few thousand years of history. The cryptos, as neat as they are, they're just tulips. It's a tulip mania. We don't know how high it's going to go. Analysts think that the cryptos can take 10% of the global currency market. There's no reason to believe the precious metals couldn't also procure another 10 or maybe 20% of said Forex market, which makes 10,000 that Dr. Lieb gave us yesterday on the show a lowball forecast.
No, I don't know about the 10,000 number, but I'm as bullish as can be, and probably, you know, the Feds would expect that, but you're absolutely correct in what you're saying. It's coming. Again, think pressure cooker. And when we start to go up this time in gold and silver, it will not be like we've seen in over the years past. It will be explosive. And again, the second, third time, Bitcoin is like the roadmap for what's coming in gold and silver once this gold cartel is forced to retreat or give up what they're doing.
You know, even some of the more bearish guests we've had on the show agree the worst is past for the precious metal. Sure, we're going to back and fill. We're going to see sine wave action. That's normal. This is a volatile market. The majority of the volatility will be on the upside. I think the takeaway point here from Bill Murphy today is it's a matter of time. We want to make sure we let everyone know about GATA.org and La Metropole.
Yeah, well, as said often, Chris Powell, my colleague, does a great job at GATA.org. People can sign up and get on his list. And I've been doing my La Metropole Cafe thing since 1998 and got a ways to go, so they can sign up for a 2-week free trial there and see if it's of value. Okay, bye-bye.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. Inflation is an issue that continues to be debated by academics and statisticians on one side, who support the Bureau of Labor Statistics methodology for calculating inflation, and those on the other side who question the accuracy of such calculations, believing that official inflation numbers are greatly understated because of such things as not including food and energy, and the relativism employed in such calculations by equivocating, for example, technological advancements against whether the cost of something should be treated as inflation, can all make for a very clouded debate between experts and everyone else, when everyone else is often labeled by those experts as not understanding or possessing misconceptions about the consumer price index. We live at a time when 6 out of 10 Americans cannot come up with $500 for an emergency situation. No doubt, inflation calculations are being made by individuals who are not in that demographic. When your income is higher, your expenditure on items like food and health care relative to your total income are lower, and therefore cost differences can often go unnoticed. But for over half the population, even a small increase in costs can have an explosive impact on one's budget. I have commented at length in past discussions how food manufacturers have, over the years, surreptitiously reduced package sizes to avoid raising costs to the consumer. There is another deception, or should I say misdirection, that I believe is beginning in order to condition shoppers for what could quickly become much higher food prices. The grocery store I frequent recently upgraded all its scanners at the checkout lines. Now, when you scan a grocery item, a computer voice announces the often higher, supposed retail price of that item, and then announces the savings discount you are receiving. For example, a gallon of skim milk initially rings up at $3.49. The computer voice announces this, but then follows up by saying, savings of $1.20. So in effect, I am charged only $2.29. This creates the impression I am getting a significant discount on certain grocery products. Over time, I become accustomed to thinking I am getting a good value. But the other thing I, and everyone else, is getting reinforced is that the actual price is really $3.49. Therefore, at some point in the future, when prices do spike, the store can raise a gallon of milk to $3.49 without really acknowledging that price has risen. This pattern is reinforced subtly by adjusting certain products periodically between their higher price and the special discounted price. A box of donuts, for example, rings up at $4.99, but periodically goes down to $2.99, a savings of $2. But then it goes back up the next week. This is subtle long-term conditioning. More and more products are showing a higher retail price and currently showing a nice, healthy discount for the time being. When product sizes can't be shrunk any further, this mechanism of raising the advertised retail price, discounting it for customer loyalty reasons, and allowing a healthy window for future price increases without calling them price increases is, I believe, the next step in denying and disowning the significant price inflation that we will all experience, while those who attempt to manage public perceptions and deceptions with the illusion of no inflation try to deceive us one more time. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.